students from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, with us. Would they stand, please, so we can see them? Good. Well, thank you for coming, and I think you have lunch with Justice Babbage. He's buying.
Whoops.
You've been introduced to us now. Why don't I introduce the bench? On the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. And to his right is an empty chair, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley sits there generally, but she will not be participating in this case. And on the far right is Justice David Prosser. 97-2389-D in the matter of disciplinary proceedings against Stephen M. Lucarelli. You will first hear from Thomas J. Basting, Sr., who will represent the Board of Attorney Professional Responsibility. Mr. Basting.
Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court, my name is Thomas J. Basting, Sr. of the Brennan Style Basting and McDougall firm in Janesville. I am here this morning as counsel to the Board of Attorneys Professional Responsibility. This case this morning deals with the special responsibilities of a prosecutor. It deals with a prosecutor who the board alleges wrongly, without probable cause, intentionally issued a criminal charge against a defense attorney on the eve of a criminal trial, and who now attempts to avoid sanctions by saying, "I forgot the facts." The Supreme Court rule in question, 20:3.8(a), simply states that a prosecutor shall refrain from prosecuting a charge that the prosecutor knows is not supported by probable cause. Differing interpretations of that rule, which is before this court, I believe, for probably the first time on this issue, are being urged upon this court by the different parties to this particular litigation. The respondent and the Wisconsin District Attorneys Association are urging one interpretation, and the board is urging another. We submit, however, that this court need not reach the issue of what the rule means in that regard, because as we asserted before the referee and as we asserted in our pleadings in this case, the referee should have, and this court should apply the doctrine of issue preclusion to find, as the Court of Appeals did in District 3, that the respondent, Mr. Lucarelli, intentionally issued a criminal complaint knowing that it was not supported by probable cause. The District 3 Court of Appeals issued its published decision in October of 1996, October 1st to be exact. The underlying facts, although I was not going to go to them in detail, I think are important to talk about this morning because the facts that were before the referee in this case are the same facts that were before the District 3 Court of Appeals and before the trial court, Judge Moore in Vilas County, where the matter that was decided by the Court of Appeals first arose. On March 17th, St. Patrick's Day, 1993, John Lattice was charged with two counts of first-degree sexual assault of his three-year-old daughter. Trial was set for March 7th of 1994, and on Friday afternoon, March 4th, 1994, just one working day before the trial was to commence, while motions were being argued in that case, the respondent, Mr. Lucarelli, served Mr. Lattice's defense attorney, Dennis Berge, with a criminal complaint charging Mr. Berge, the defense attorney, with publicly disclosing a confidential healthcare record. The so-called healthcare record was one page of handwritten notes from the files of a Dr. Gina Keppel, psychologist in Vilas County. The state's expert in the sexual assault trial. The notes were of an interview that Dr. Keppel had with the alleged victim, the child, and the notes identified a perpetrator other than the charged defendant, Mr. Lattice. In an earlier hearing in that case, the trial court had ruled that the notes of Dr. Keppel were not health care records. The respondent was at that hearing and, in fact, argued at that hearing. And after an in-camera inspection of the records, Judge Moore turned the notes over to defense counsel with a copy to the respondent in this case. After charging the defense attorney, Berge, with the crime of disclosing a health care record, the respondent at the same time moved to disqualify Mr. Berge as defense counsel. The trial court denied that motion, and the respondent then attempted to get the District 3 Court of Appeals to reverse by filing an emergency appeal over the weekend. Counsel. District 3 Court of Appeals denied
counsel,
the...
Yes. I don't mean to interrupt, but just so that I'm following, and I appreciate the factual background, but I want to ask you right up front, what the standard of review in this case is what? Is it a matter of just credibility?
We don't believe the standard of review in this case is credibility. I understand the referee has made a finding that Mr. Lucarelli forgot, and I'm prepared to argue that this morning because I don't believe that the record supports that particular finding, which...
It's a finding of fact.
Yes.
So it has to be clearly erroneous?
Clearly erroneous.
Okay.
I agree, and we asserted that in our brief that we filed, and the board understands that clearly erroneous on that issue is important.
Let me just talk about issue preclusion while you're doing the facts. When you recite the facts, I want you to tell us, if you would, what opportunity Mr. Lucarelli had in these proceedings before the Court of Appeals or the trial court to testify and subject the witnesses to cross-examination on the issue of whether he intentionally, knowingly filed the complaint without probable cause.
In the motion for a new trial that was filed by Mr. Lattice's attorney following the conviction of the two counts of sexual assault, Judge Moore heard testimony, and the state was no longer represented by Mr. Lucarelli because he was going to be a witness at that proceeding, and Mr. Lucarelli testified in that proceeding. And from our standpoint, we believe that he was well represented, his position was well represented by counsel from the Department of Justice who appeared in those proceedings. And he did testify, and the District 3 Court of Appeals commented on his testimony as well.
Well, Mr. Bastings, did Mr. Lucarelli have the opportunity? Well, let me preface it this way. About a year ago, and I can't recall the case, but I wrote it, where the issue arose about issue preclusion, and there were grandparents that said that they should have the opportunity to raise many of the same claims that had been raised by a son. And we said that they were not precluded because they were not a party, they had not had the opportunity to call witnesses or to cross-examine witnesses, etc. And I can't see where Mr. Lucarelli had that opportunity either.
Justice Babich, if you look at it from the standpoint of a straight representation, but as we pointed out the cases in our brief, this court has also held on other occasions that issue preclusion does not require, when you're considering that doctrine, that there is exact identity of parties. And in this case, we don't believe it was necessary for Mr. Lucarelli to have been a party to that proceeding.
But did he have the opportunity to call witnesses on his own behalf?
He had his...
In front of the Court of Appeals or the trial court?
Well, obviously not in front of the Court of Appeals, but in the trial court, at the hearing on the motion for a new trial, being represented by counsel from the Department of Justice, could have called as many witnesses as he wanted. It's my understanding of the proceedings. The state, he was called as a witness, and he did testify, as did DeWitt Strong, who was the principal witness for the board in these proceedings before the referee.
Those proceedings were designed to determine a matter between the state and a defendant in a criminal case. And they were designed to determine whether the conviction should be opened or overturned, in effect. I mean, that was the point of the motion, right?
The point of the motion was to seek a new trial upon the grounds that Mr. Lattice's constitutional rights had been deprived because of the ineffective assistance of counsel arising out of the charges against defense counsel by Mr. Lucarelli. So the question before Judge Moore, we believe, was did Mr. Lucarelli intentionally issue a criminal complaint against defense counsel without probable cause? That was the issue that Judge Moore and the Court of Appeals dealt with, same issue that is in these proceedings.
What was the burden of proof?
To overturn the conviction of
the motion for a new trial, right?
Pardon me?
Motion for a new trial.
Motion for a new trial to overturn the conviction. The trial court, the burden of proof in those circumstances, we assert, was stronger than clear and convincing evidence, which was the burden in this case.
I gather it's your position that on the basis of this record, I'm jumping ahead. Your first position is issue preclusion.
That's correct.
Then that would just end the case, because you'd say there was a finding that there was intentional knowing complaint without probable cause.
Correct. We alleged in our complaint in this court that the trial court and the Court of Appeals findings against the respondent and asked the referee to preclude the respondent from relitigating the same issues. And the referee declined to do so on two occasions. That motion was raised twice during the proceedings before the referee. The referee refused to apply issue preclusion and found that although Mr. Lucarelli had wrongfully charged Mr. Berge, whatever wrongfully means in the context of the referee's findings, Mr. Lucarelli had forgotten, the referee said, that the Keppel records were not health care records, and that because he had forgotten, he therefore didn't violate the rules. So what we have now is just exactly what the doctrine we assert of issue preclusion is supposed to prevent. The Court of Appeals, in a published decision, has said that the respondent had no probable cause to charge the defense attorney Berge with a crime. The Court of Appeals said that Mr. Lucarelli's suggestion that he may have forgotten, and that's a quote, that he may have forgotten about the court's ruling was not acceptable. The Court of Appeals accepted the testimony, as did the referee, of Assistant District Attorney DeWitt Strong, who said that Mr. Lucarelli told him three or four times that the reason he charged, that I shouldn't say that, not the reason he charged, but that he was looking for an adjournment before the trial. The Court of Appeals found, as did the trial court, that Mr. Lucarelli filed the charge either to disqualify defense counsel or to delay the trial. And most importantly, Court of Appeals found that Mr. Lucarelli's misconduct was intentional.
One of the problems is the Court of Appeals theoretically should not be making any findings of fact.
Understand.
So when you say the Court of Appeals found, I have a little problem with that. The Court of Appeals can only say that the, as this court can only say, that the trial court made a finding and that that finding is supported by or not supported by the evidence.
That's correct. And what I should have said, Mr. Chief Justice, is that the Court of Appeals affirmed Judge Moore's finding that the conduct of Mr. Lucarelli was, in fact, intentional when he issued the charge against Mr. Berge.
In other words, as I recall the facts, that Moore found that there was, prosecutorial misconduct? Is that what?
That's correct. And Judge Moore had found that the misconduct, so the issuing of the criminal charge, so affected the defense attorney during the trial that, in fact, it rendered him ineffective, and that was the reason that the conviction was then later overturned. So we have the Court of Appeals telling the public.
Mr. Basin.
Yes. I'm sorry, Justice Prosser.
I'm not entirely clear what would happen if you prevail here. Is it all over? I mean, do we just find that certain facts have been established by other courts, and then make a judgment on those facts? Or what exactly is the procedure here?
It's the board's assertion that if issue preclusion should have, and if this court decides that it does apply, that the Court of Appeals decision, in fact, should have precluded the relitigation before the referee of the core issue of a violation of the rule, that the referee, because the referee did not deal with sanctions, can be then sent back to the referee, I suppose, to make a recommendation back to this court as to what sanctions should be imposed upon the respondent under those circumstances. I think that's where we are.
Now, Mr. Hastings, as I read your brief, it seems to me you, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm looking for the theory of your case here. You've put your eggs in two baskets, one being the basket of issue preclusion. If you lose on that issue, nevertheless, you seem to be saying behind door number two or in basket number two, the referee's findings with respect to Mr. Lucarelli's knowledge are incorrect, are erroneous.
That's correct.
And nothing more. You're not relying upon any other wordings of the code or anything else. These are the two theories that you've got going.
As we have argued in our brief, the rule 3.8a, one of the questions, if the court reaches that rule and requires an analysis and a decision as to what that rule means in the context of this case, it's the board's assertion that that rule means that the I forgot defense, as asserted by the respondent in this case, is not a defense to that rule. That the standard of what knowledge means in the context of that rule, that standard should be more of a negligence standard than it should be an intentional standard. Because I don't know how anybody could ever violate the rule the way the referee interpreted it in this case.
Do you see your position fundamentally the opposite of the District Attorney's Association?
Yes.
On that issue.
Okay, now what? Where do you get the negligence language? Where do you get the negligence basis?
As we argued in our brief, the definition in the rule that this court has promulgated, which the rule itself simply used the words knows is not supported by probable cause, is defined as knowledge being able to be found from the circumstances. Our assertion is that because that is the definition in the beginning or the preamble of the rule,
that sets up more of a negligent standard than the standard that the referee viewed it, and that was that in order to violate that rule, you have to prove that there was actual knowledge as rather than knowledge inferred from the circumstances.
Well, if somebody says, I know, and testifies, I know, then that's the end of it. I mean, you can take it as face value. Somebody says, I forgot, then the issue is whether you believe that he forgot, right?
If I forgot is a defense.
Yeah. Was it a defense here?
I don't believe so.
What was the defense?
The defense is that I had probable cause when I issued, and I knew I had probable cause when I issued the criminal complaint against Mr. Berge, and I didn't issue it for reasons of harassment or any other improper reasons in the other rule that we cited that the referee found, because he allowed the I forgot defense to be a defense to that rule as well, and that is the taking an action for harassment or malicious purposes.
You're saying that the I forgot defense was only as to one charge but not the other?
Well, no, I think he used it for both, and I think the referee found it applied to both.
All right. So you said at that time when I filed, I thought everything was okay because I thought that it was confidential. I had forgotten that it was not confidential.
I had forgotten that the court in a proceeding where I was present ruled
exactly
that it was not confidential.
And that proceeding was how many weeks before?
That proceeding was on February 17th. On February 16th, the proceeding was at the previous September. There was then, on February 16th, just several weeks before the charge was issued, Attorney Berge filed his motion with the court with the one-page Keppel notes attached to the motion. On February 17th, both Mr. Berge and respondent discussed the motion in open court, but it was the previous September, I don't have that exact date in front of me, that the ruling on the Keppel notes was made.
Now, the terminology in 20:1, whatever it is, I guess this is the preamble, no denotes actual knowledge of the fact in question. Okay.
Yes.
And then it says a person's knowledge may be inferred from the circumstances, and that's because if somebody says, I didn't know, you can say, hey, I don't believe you, you did know. And you knew it because, and this is what you're saying, you knew it because, look, you found out about that in September, should have, I don't believe that you forgot. Now, if I understand you, are you saying that this falls under reasonably should know, that a lawyer of reasonable prudence and competence would ascertain the matter in question, or reasonably believe when used in reference to a lawyer denotes that the lawyer believes the matter in question and that the circumstances are such that the better is reasonable?
The reasonably should know definition is in a different section of the preamble than the knows. I understand that. And that's the argument that the respondent and the District Attorneys Association is making, that therefore, if the court meant this to be a negligent standard, it would have referred to reasonably
right
should knows.
Right. Do you think those two standards are the same, reasonably should know and know knowledge inferred from the circumstances?
I think that you can read them as the same, yes.
Mr. Basting,
the referee, yes, Justice Bandlich.
I wanted to follow up on the Chief's questions here. It seems to me that when Mr. Lucarelli, in essence, says, I forgot that these were confidential, and therefore, I mean, if these had been confidential, certainly he would have had probable cause. So he's saying, I forgot that they were not confidential. It seems to me like the referee made a finding on credibility, and he believed Mr. Lucarelli. Now, if he did, We owe that, as you well know, you know, a great deal of deference.
I understand that.
So are you asking to say that his findings are clearly erroneous? And do you concede that this is a question of credibility?
The question of I forgot is a question of credibility, but one needs to read what the referee wrote to decide whether that finding was clearly erroneous. And I agree with you that on an issue of credibility, as I stated before, that we do have to show that the referee was clearly erroneous. The referee wrote, for example, that Mr. Lucarelli was, quote, legally responsible, unquote, for knowing that the Keppel notes were not confidential health care records. I don't know what the referee meant by that. What did he mean when he said he was legally responsible for knowing that, but then says, but he forgot, and so therefore he is not responsible for violating this rule? Also, the referee totally ignored a question that I asked Mr. Lucarelli, and this is on page 902 of the record. And I asked Mr. Lucarelli if he would have had a specific recollection when he charged Mr. Berge with this crime, that if he had absolute conscious recollection that the judge had ruled these were not health care records, would it have made any difference in his actions? And he said no. Now, the referee clearly overlooked that, and we believe that the record under those circumstances, the referee was clearly erroneous when he made his findings that under the state of this record, that Mr. Lucarelli forgot, and therefore he is not responsible. So, my time is up.
Well, okay, counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Does anyone else have a question? I do have one question. What were the sections of the code or the oath that were charged here? I don't know if the charges were in the appendices.
Find that quickly. The Supreme Court Rule 40.15 is the attorney's oath. 20:8.4 says it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to violate the attorney's oath. The portion of the oath involved is the portion that says, I will not counsel or maintain any suit or proceeding which shall appear to me to be unjust, or any defense except as I believe to be honestly debatable under the law of the land. The meritorious claims is 20:3.1, which states, in representing a client, a lawyer shall not assert a position, file a suit, delay a trial, or take other action on behalf of a client, here the state, when the lawyer knows or when it is obvious that such an action would serve merely to harass or maliciously injure another.
Can I follow up on that, Chief?
You done? Are those the only ones?
Those were the charges. Well, 8.3A, which is the prosecutor's duty, and then 3.1, which is the meritorious claims, and the violation of the oath. The referee said he didn't violate any of those.
Okay. Thank you. The one that you read last regarding meritorious claims and contentions, I read that in the disjunctive because it uses the word or and establishes both a subjective violation and an objective violation.
I agree.
One that turns on the subjective intent of the lawyer, and the other that turns on objective evaluation by a court of the facts of the situation.
Yes.
Okay. And I also have a sort of a global question. Can you conceive of a situation in which established prosecutorial misconduct would not violate some section of the code?
It's It's an interesting question. I don't know if we have enough time. When you say established prosecutorial misconduct.
Well, that's what we have in this case. We have established prosecutorial misconduct. It's gone through the Court of Appeals.
That's correct.
It's been established and is the law of the case. And my question is whether there are any circumstances under which that would not also constitute a violation of some section of the rules of professional misconduct.
Well, we believe that we asserted the rules that the conduct did violate and took the position that the conduct, as the misconduct as found by the trial court and affirmed by the Court of Appeals, in fact, did violate these sections. And the referee, once he made the finding that Mr. Lucarelli forgot, didn't look at any of these other issues and simply said, and therefore he didn't violate any of the others either.
I mean,
he did not spend much time in his analysis of the other charges.
Well, and to ask it another way, a more common sense sort of a way, if it's conduct that's bad enough to throw out a criminal conviction, which has been established beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury.
Yes.
Isn't it also, by definition, a violation of any number of rules of professional misconduct, including some of the global ones that incorporate the requirement of honesty and duties to the court as an officer of the court?
They could be. We did not specifically charge those here, but yes, I agree that they could be.
Well, we have taken the position that even though a court concludes that a matter is frivolous, that is not a violation per se of the code. How would you justify those two issues? And then, suppose there's a mistrial because there's prosecutorial misconduct and closing statement or failure to reveal information under Brady.
I think I understand the question, and that is there are some instances where courts find misconduct by lawyers in a civil situation, such as a finding of frivolous costs, where this court has said that does not automatically translate into precluding an issue preclusion in a subsequent assertion of misconduct by the Board of Attorneys' professional responsibility. I think the court has to look at those on a case-by-case basis and has to say, in this case, misconduct by Mr. Lucarelli here in what he did, and the finding of the trial court, the fact that we have a prosecutor in a situation where a convicted criminal defendant, sexual assault of a child, where his conviction was overturned because of that prosecutorial misconduct, I think in this case, the court can look at that and say, under those facts, we would preclude those issues from having been relitigated in the subsequent proceeding.
Thanks, Basting.
Thank you.
You have several minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Lucarelli.
Good morning. May it please the court, board counsel Mr. Basting. 45 years ago today I was born. And if somebody had told me that today I would be spending my birthday with you six folks, I would have doubted them. But I am here nonetheless under what most people would probably admit are some very difficult circumstances. And sometimes when one is dealing with circumstances like this, it is a ripe opportunity to pause and reflect. And that's something that I've tried to do here. And sometimes when you are dealing with a matter as serious as this is, recognizing it for what it is often helps you deal with the situation. The words that kept going through my mind as I prepared for this argument were, words of former appeals court judge Dan LaRocque that I read in an interview with him one time in the Milwaukee Journal, where he was asked his opinion of the decision in the famous LaRocque v. LaRocque case. And he said, as an appellate court judge, I thought I would always make new law. I just never thought it would be this way. I never expected to be before you arguing my first case in front of the Supreme Court with myself as a defendant. Sometimes humor helps us understand what's important and what isn't, but at the same time, there may be a need to focus on the seriousness of the issue that we're dealing with as well. And the seriousness of this issue was driven home to me this past weekend when on Sunday morning I received a phone call at my house, the caller telling me that a close personal friend had died in a construction accident in Racine, Wisconsin. For those of you who read the Milwaukee Journal, you may have seen the article yesterday indicated that a man by the name of Anthony Azarian died when a ditch collapsed on him at a construction project. As I read that article and woke up this morning and looked across from my bed to the bed where my wife and my son were sleeping, I came to understand that my problems today, whatever they may be, are nothing in comparison to the problems that Mrs. Azarian's widow and her six kids face. And I also realized that the way business is done in the construction industry in Racine at this time is perhaps different than it's done in Milwaukee County, where Milwaukee County has had the benefit of a prosecutor in the form of E. Michael McCann, who was here today, and I didn't know was going to be here today, but nonetheless, I think praise is due in the circumstance here, who has taken a rather novel, courageous, an intriguing approach to charging and holding construction companies responsible in these cases when ditches collapse and kill workers. And because of his actions as a prosecutor, I believe many lives have been saved in Milwaukee County, where we don't have widows and children without a father as we do in the Azarian case. And I question whether or not, when people wrote the criminal negligence statute, they ever anticipated that it would be applied in this manner. I question whether or not, in ascertaining the facts in these cases, Mr. McCann has ever been able to determine whether a mound of soil collapsed because of somebody's negligence or because it was an act of God. But nonetheless, he seemed fit to issue charges in those cases to make a determination that probable cause existed and to go forward. And as a result, people's lives have probably been saved. And I wonder if the same knowing standard advocated by the board here today was applied in those cases, or had been applied prior to issuance of the charges in those cases, whether or not Mr. McCann would have felt as comfortable issuing the charges in those cases as he did. I'd like to take a moment to read a quote that I think summarizes the issue before this court at this time. It's from a U.S. Supreme Court case, Imbler versus Pachman, and quotes a California decision, Pearson versus Reed, and it talks about the duties of the public prosecutor. The office of public prosecutor is one which must be administered with courage and independence. Yet how can this be if the prosecutor is made subject to suit by those whom he accuses and fails to convict? To allow this would open the way for unlimited harassment and embarrassment of the most conscientious officials by those who would profit thereby. There would be involved in every case the possible consequences of a failure to obtain conviction. There would always be a question of possible civil action in the case where the prosecutor saw fit to move for a dismissal of the case. The apprehension of such consequences would tend toward great uneasiness and toward weakening the fearless and impartial policy which should characterize the administration of this office. The work of the prosecutor would thus be impeded, and we would have moved away from the desired objective of stricter and fairer enforcement of our laws. And from later in that same decision, frequently acting under serious constraints of time and even information, a prosecutor inevitably makes many decisions that could engender colorable claims of constitutional deprivation. Defending these decisions often years after they were made, could impose unique and intolerable burdens upon a prosecutor responsible annually for hundreds of indictments and trials, quoting Bradley versus Fisher in that opinion as well. The standard advocated by the board here today is essentially one of negligence. It finds no support in the plain and unambiguous language of the rule that I'm alleged to have violated, SCR 20:3.8. This is a question of statutory construction, in this case, a question of the construction of a rule of this court. The language of the rule is clear, and when it is clear, the court cannot refer to extrinsic sources to aid in interpreting its language. The rule reads, a prosecutor in a criminal case shall refrain from prosecuting a charge that the prosecutor knows is not supported by probable cause. In the definition portion of the rules, knows is defined as denotes actual knowledge of the fact in question. A person's knowledge may be inferred from circumstances.
Mr. Lucarelli, I'd like to interrupt you at this point.
Yes, Judge.
Try to hold off 5 minutes or so. The referee here made a finding that you did not know.
Correct.
In fact, I believe he says something like you were very persuasive in showing that. Mr. Lucarelli, this is on page 515, Mr. Lucarelli showed persuasively he did not remember the ruling. If we're to find for you, we're going to have to go into that record to find out upon what he based that ruling. What are the primary blocks, building blocks, that he based that ruling on in your judgment? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
One item.
That are in the record, that are found in the record.
Yes, sir. One thing that he found was that Judge Moore and Mr. Berge forgot the prior ruling as well. That derives from the fact that on March 7th, the first day of the trial, a motion for prosecutorial misconduct was brought before Judge Moore by Mr. Berge, and nowhere in the face of that motion is there any allegation that there had been a prior ruling by the trial court concerning the issue alleged in the complaint, and nowhere in addressing that motion did Judge Moore ever indicate there had been a prior ruling, and therefore this had been error on my part to issue the charge. In fact, Judge Moore denied the motion that was brought at that time. The failure of both of those men to make any allegation based on the court's September 17th ruling suggests that they forgot as well, and Mr. Schweitzer noted that. Second, Mr. Schweitzer noted that when I went to find the records, they were being maintained in a sealed file. When I went to find them, you have to understand that the court, after its in-camera review, transmitted these records to both Mr. Berge and myself under a cover letter. The problem was, when I went to look for them in our file, some weeks, months later, they weren't there. I saw the cover letter, but there were no records, and I went through the file, which was large and voluminous from top to bottom. When they weren't there, I then went to the court and I said, I don't think we got our records, or if we did, they've been misplaced, but can I get another copy? And what I discovered was the records were being maintained by the clerk in a sealed file marked medical records confidential in Judge Moore's handwriting. This was on March 3rd of the year that I issued the charge against Mr. Berge. The other thing the referee found was that the transcript of the September 17, 1993 hearing was not transcribed until August of 1994, 11 months later. There therefore was no transcript transcribed that a party could have gone back to review if they'd been so inclined, which I was not, because I did not recall what had gone on during that hearing on September 17th. However, there was no transcribed transcript, and therefore there wasn't anything readily available that a party could have even looked at. He also looked at the context of the ruling that occurred in September when Mr. Berge went in and asked to have Dr. Keppel's records disclosed. And he said essentially it was a stipulation between the lawyers to get a review. If you read that transcript carefully, you'll see that after the second page, Judge Moore could have made his ruling, because I was essentially saying, I think you can order the records turned over to you. Mr. Berge was essentially saying, to start with, My client gets them because they're medical records, and as the child's guardian or father, he's entitled to get them. And then he later changed to say, well, if you think you can order them turned over to you, I'll take them that way. And that could have been the end of the court's...
Okay, but why does that establish that you didn't know or that you forgot?
Because the focus of that hearing, in my mind, to start with, was not going to be on whether these were or were not confidential medical records. It was going to be, we'll stipulate that the court gets these records for in-camera review and then decides what's to do with them, what it will do with them once it has them. And because it was not the focus of my intentions going into that hearing, obviously some 6 months later, it wasn't something that was going to stand out in my mind.
The focus of what? Focus of confidentiality?
Correct. The fact that these were or weren't medical records, none of that was something, I guess, that...
Well, why would you have an in-camera proceeding if they weren't, at least, looked like medical records? Otherwise, you just turn them over. So the concept of an in-camera hearing was that these may have confidential information.
The question of confidential records is an extremely difficult issue for any prosecutor to deal with, for a court to deal with.
Right.
If we go back and we look at this court's decision in Solberg, what you'll find is Margaret Moeller arguing to this court that in 20 years as an appellate lawyer handling criminal appeals, this is the most difficult issue she's ever dealt with. And you'll find Justice Bradley concurring in that assessment of what we're dealing with here. And the problem as a prosecutor is, under Brady versus Maryland, we have a duty to turn over exculpatory information. What do you do if the exculpatory information is in a patient's confidential medical record, where we now have another level of privacy that attaches to that record that belongs to another person? Do you, as the prosecutor, have a right to invade that person's privacy rights to satisfy your ethical duties under Brady versus Maryland? And here, the safest thing seemed to be, and you have to understand this because I think this is a very crucial fact, we didn't have the records on September 17th. We didn't have the benefit of Dr. Keppel's testimony on that day. Essentially, the trial court was being placed in a ruling that something was or wasn't something that it couldn't see, and that it didn't have the benefit of the testimony of the person who had compiled those records to help it identify what they were. That was a problem in its own right. And I think if there was error that occurred on that day, and I believe there was, it probably happened because we didn't have those records there. And here's another difficulty the law presents. The law says, as I interpret Solberg and your other decisions, Schiffer and Spies, as Even judges may not have the right to look at these records until the patient says it's okay initially.
Did you know at the time of that hearing what the doctor's evaluation of the child revealed?
What I knew was that the doctor, through a phone call to me, had interviewed the child, that the child, according to her, was testifying truthfully in her interview, or not testifying, but talking to her truthfully, that she had identified her father as the perpetrator of the assaults on her, that her characteristics and actions in the interview were consistent with other child sexual assault victims. And that was my purpose in sending the child to be evaluated, was to determine those issues, because we had a four-year-old who was having a very difficult time communicating at that point in time about what had happened. During the initial oral discussion with Dr. Keppel, there was no identification at that point in time of an alternate perpetrator. And when Dr. Keppel and I first met to establish our professional relationship, she asked me, do you want me to write a report in each of these cases? And I said, well, what will that cost us? And she said, $125 an hour for my time. In my county, on my budget, I could not afford to pay an expert witness that kind of money to write a report that she could easily, in less time, communicate to me on the telephone. So based on our initial conversation, I didn't believe that she had generated notes or reports in the course of this conversation with the little girl. And because this is the first child psychologist who I ever worked with in a case like this, I didn't know that what I do now is a matter of standard procedure. Most psychologists, if not all, keep notes of their meetings with their patients. In any event, I didn't mean to divert from your question. I think that this presents a very difficult circumstance for a prosecutor in any case because of the intertwining interests that we have here. And it seemed to me that day the safest thing to do was to say, Judge Moore, you get the records because I'm afraid to do anything here under the circumstances.
To remind you of my question, it was what are the building blocks of
correct.
The facts that the judge relied, or the referee relied on, and you've given us
the other building block is, or the other blocks are, the decision was made 6 months after the court's ruling in September, and that people forget. There were over 30 separate motions filed in this case.
In that interim?
During the period of time from when the charges were initiated up to the time of trial, up to the point where now the charging decision is taking place, there were approximately 30 different motions that were filed. I don't profess to have a photographic memory. My wife painfully reminds me every year that I've forgotten her birthday, and often our anniversary. People forget things. Justice Babbage, in your dissent in Solberg, you said judges are fallible, are human and therefore fallible. Prosecutors are too. And I don't remember every argument that I've ever made in front of a court in my career as a prosecutor. I don't remember every ruling, word for word, that's come down in every court I've appeared in front of. I was here a week ago to watch this court to become familiar with your procedures again. And frankly, I can't remember much of what was discussed just a week ago in those arguments. The other thing the referee relied on was my testimony. He said that I had testified that I forgot. And he said that I testified that I forgot persuasively. He assessed my credibility and he indicated that in the 2 years approximately that this case was pending, he'd had a chance to assess me personally and he found, in his opinion, that I acted on a high ethical plane, that I attempted to be honest, that I was an aggressive lawyer, and that sometimes aggressive lawyers are misperceived, and that his assessment of my character was consistent with the testimony of five circuit court judges who testified on my behalf and two district attorneys. And I have to say that it is at times like this, when we are dealing with accusations like this, sometimes the only thing we can rely on as people and as lawyers is how we've led our life in the past as an example of how we may have acted on a particular day. I believe that those things summarize the building blocks that the referee built his determination on. And I would point out here that if the court finds that the findings are inadequate, the remedy here as requested is not reversal. It probably should be remand to the referee to allow him to make further findings of fact consistent with this court's opinion. The suggestion has been made that I should be precluded or should have been precluded from relitigating the issue of my misconduct as found by Judge Moore and the Court of Appeals. Were that to be done, I believe it would be the first case that I'm aware of where a witness in a prior proceeding is found to have been bound by some finding in that proceeding as a result of the witness's testimony, and where the party advocating the offensive use of issue preclusion was not a party to the prior proceeding. There is no mutuality here at all. Now, this court has, in the last few years, relaxed the mutuality requirement in these cases, but I'm aware of no decision where it is said where neither party to the prior proceeding is now a party in a subsequent proceeding, they're going to be bound by it. And for obvious reasons, when you are not a party to the prior proceeding, you have no rights as an advocate in that proceeding. Could I have obtained review as a matter of law under the fundamental fairness analysis in Lindis versus Katie? No. Neither I nor the board were a party to that proceeding, and I'm aware of no decision which says that a witness could appeal an unfavorable result. And that applies both to the trial court's decision and the Court of Appeals decision. Is the question one of law involving two distinct claims or intervening contextual shifts in the law? There are two distinct claims here. In the proceeding before Judge Moore, the claim was that Mr. Lattice was entitled to a new trial either due to conflict of interest of his attorney or a violation of his Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights. The issues in the disciplinary proceeding were, did I violate SCR 20:3.8, 3.1A3, and 40.15, the attorney's oath? If you look at Judge Moore's decision and the Court of Appeals decision, you will see that there is no specific discussion of any Supreme Court rule violation in either of those decisions. And even if one takes the discussion concerning lack of probable cause in Judge Moore's decision as an implicit discussion of SCR 23.8, he uses a should-have-known standard in assessing whether or not there was probable cause, which is not the standard that this court has relied on. In disciplinary proceedings against Rabideau, this court said there are public interests addressed in a disciplinary proceeding that are not addressed in criminal proceedings. Quoting from that case, the authority of the bar and this court to consider matters pertaining to the qualifications to practice law cannot be waived or determined by other parties. Do significant differences in the quality or extensiveness between the two courts warrant relitigation? In the hearing before Judge Moore and Mr. Lattice's motion for a new trial, I testified for approximately 1 hour. The entire hearing lasted 1 day. The disciplinary proceeding in this case took 6 days of testimony, generated close to 2,000 pages of record, and approximately 24 witnesses testified, and there were approximately 150 exhibits, where the sole issue before the referee was the alleged rule violations. I was represented by counsel in this proceeding. I was not represented by counsel in the motion before Judge Moore. I could conduct discovery and compel witnesses to testify in this proceeding. I could not do that in the motion before Judge Moore. I could present testimony here and cross-examine witnesses called against me. I could not do that in the proceeding before Judge Moore. I could appeal the result of this decision. I could not appeal the result of the motion hearing before Judge Moore. In short,
all of the due process rights normally required for a minimally fair hearing were present in the disciplinary proceeding, but were not afforded to me as a mere witness in the motion hearing before Judge Moore or the appeal to the Court of Appeals. Are matters of public policy and individual circumstance involved that would result in fundamental unfairness, inadequate opportunity or incentive to obtain a full and fair adjudication in the initial action? I believe as a matter of public policy, it is better to decide claims of unethical conduct by lawyers in disciplinary proceedings specifically established for that purpose. This court would not be spending all of the time that it has revising the present disciplinary system if we could substitute in its place hearings before trial courts or appellate courts. Issue preclusion under these circumstances would turn every witness in an action into a potential litigant in that action. Nobody would want to testify for fear the decision out of the proceeding might impact them unfavorably at some point in the future. As a witness in Mr. Latisse's motion hearing, there was no opportunity for me to obtain a full and fair adjudication. You have to recall this. At the time of Mr. Latisse's motion hearing before Judge Moore, the initial complaint filed against me in this action, alleging these facts, had been heard, considered, and dismissed by former administrator of the Board of Attorneys, Gerald Sternberg. Therefore, at the time I testified, there was no reason to believe that anything that came out of that hearing would later be used in this proceeding in an effort to foreclose me from me being even able to defend against the allegation. As pointed out by Professor Christine Weissman, who testified on my behalf, the wrong law was used. The wrong substantive law was used in both of the preceding decisions. Review of the briefs filed by the Public Defender's Office in Mr. Latisse's motion hearing shows that they argued the wrong law, a law that did not come into effect until 4 months after I filed the charges against Mr. Burden. It would be fundamentally unfair to allow a person to be precluded from litigating an issue based on an erroneous prior application of the law. And as a reference, I would simply refer you to footnote 2 of the Court of Appeals decision, where they identify the law that they used as a basis for affirming Judge Moore's decision. And if you look at that law, you will see that it is nothing like the law that was in effect at the time I filed the charges against Mr. Berge. Finally, Mr. Schweitzer said that he had limited my case accordingly and that I had not been allowed to introduce evidence showing that the trial court decision was affected by improper factors. There seems to be something about this case and my birthday, because 5 years ago when I turned 40, I got a phone call telling me that I was the subject of an ongoing John Doe investigation in Vilas County, where my conduct in this case was now being investigated as a basis for filing criminal charges against me. There were a lot of things that we would like to have been able to go into to show that there were problems with the earlier decisions that we could not. Finally, there was no harm. The board simply had to prove its case, which the referee found that it failed to do. I would like to spend a moment talking about the cross appeal in this case. It appears in his decision that the referee treated this case and my demand for costs under the frivolous pleading statute. The demand for costs was made under the general provisions of 814.03. There is no requirement to demonstrate that the losing parties were not substantially justified. The statute mandates imposition of costs if the plaintiff would not ordinarily be entitled to costs. SCR 22.20 is silent on the question of award of costs to a prevailing respondent. I must confess, from my reading of this court's decisions, it is not often that a respondent prevails in these proceedings
And I do not recall in the last 10 years a respondent prevailing ever. When there is no specific SCR, then the ordinary rules of civil procedure apply per SCR 22.23(2). Under the circumstances here, I believe fundamental fairness suggests that an award of costs is appropriate, and by costs, I do not mean what the board would be awarded were they to prevail. I'm not looking for attorney's fees, the referee's costs, etc. I'm simply talking about the out-of-pocket costs of this litigation. I submit to you that if this court adopts the standard suggested by the board, no lawyer faced with what I've been through in this case, no prosecutor, will ever want to make a close call in a case before them. I've spent out of my pocket approximately $75,000 defending against these allegations. I cannot think of any prosecutor who would want to be faced with that prospect and on top of it the loss of their livelihood. In a way, this is an abrogation of the rule of immunity for prosecutors that they've enjoyed under our system, where they've been protected from civil litigation. But I can assure you that the jails and prisons in our system are full of people who would like to see this court adopt something less than the knowing standard for a violation of this rule, because it will allow them to armchair quarterback the decisions that place them in those jails or prisons. In the process, it will chill the ability of prosecutors to effectively operate in our system of justice as fair and impartial arbiters of justice. Thank you very much. I appreciate the privilege and the opportunity to be here today. It's taken me 15 years to make it to this point. I wish it had been under different circumstances, but I hope I've done my best. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lucarelli. Mr. Baston, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Lucarelli quoted from the United States Supreme Court case, and I think it was Pacman. At least the United States Supreme Court in the Pacman case said one reason prosecutors should be accorded immunity from liability for civil rights violations allegedly occasioned by prosecutorial misconduct is that, quote, professional discipline supplies an effective remedy for prosecutorial misconduct. Let me a brief rebuttal, first of all, on the issue of the costs that form the basis for this cross-appeal by the respondent. This court has previously declined to award respondent attorneys defense costs and disciplinary proceedings either on the entire case or as to certain misconduct counts that were dismissed by the referee and upheld by this court. Those cases are the proceedings against Marcus and Tepper, the proceedings against Kelly, the proceedings against Jacobs, where reconsideration was later denied. Jacobs was a 1991 case, and in Jacobs, the court specifically addressed the issue of costs based on Section 814.025 of the statutes and held that the motion for costs based on Section 814.025 is denied. So this court has on various occasions said that a successful defense in a disciplinary action costs cannot be imposed against the board. And unless the court is prepared to overrule that, I think that that issue is dealt with in those cases. Let me also say that in response to a question by Justice Babbage, Mr. Luke, as to what are the building blocks in the record as to the referee finding that Mr. Lucarelli, on the facts of this case, had forgotten that this was a health care record. They're difficult to find in the record because it was really never the particular subject matter of anything that occurred during the course of the proceedings. And I will concede that that there are some instances in the record where you could make a determination that, yes, he said he forgot. But the referee totally overlooked the question that was asked that I referred to before when Mr. Lucarelli was asked, if you had remembered, would your action have been any different? Would you still have charged the defense attorney with a crime? And he said, my action wouldn't have been any different. And the referee totally ignored that. And you have to also look at the fact that just weeks before he charged the defense attorney with the crime in this case, on February 16th of 94, which was less than a month before this trial was to begin, Mr. Berge filed his motion with the one page of the Keppel notes attached. As the record shows, he also filed with his motion all of the police reports that went into lurid detail of what had occurred in this case. And the next day, Mr. Lucarelli was in court in front of Judge Moore with that motion in hand, and not a word was said in that record, and that's part of this record, as to this one page of health care records that had been attached. And Mr. Lucarelli at that hearing asked for more time. He said, I need more time to respond. And it was given to him. And not until 2 weeks later, on the eve of this trial, did he issue a criminal complaint against the defense attorney for publicly disclosing this one-page so-called health care record in the notes. And it's on the totality of that conduct that when you look at this record, that the referee was clearly erred in his finding that under those circumstances, the respondent here should escape sanctions because he said, I forgot. And this court should not allow that to happen. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bacon. Thank you, Mr. Lucarelli. That concludes our hearing on 97-2389-2. The court will hear its last case for the April sitting 1 week from today.